Okay, let's get started. This is the last lecture of the quarter, I saved the best for last. Does anybody have any questions on any of the material? Okay, first thing I'm going to pass around is it's very important. It's a sign-up list for next Thursday's burrito bash to celebrate the end of the quarter. We're also going to have a chance next Thursday to do an evaluation of the class. So I'd like to have you attend and fill out a pretty comprehensive evaluation of the class so I know how to make it better next year. Okay. And actually, we're getting burritos that are this big. So bring your appetite as well. I mean, it's not one per person. So it's going to be in this building. There's a terrace that's sort of off the first floor. So the best way to describe how to get there is take the elevator to the first floor, make a left, and then make a left turn at the big disc platter, which you'll see. Follow that corridor, and you'll see a lobby. And just outside the lobby is a nice terraced area with grass and stuff. And if weather permitting, We'll assemble there. Okay. So on Tuesday, I talked about some old assistive technology, and I thought I'd complement that today with some new technology. And this was an article that was written up in Computer World about 14 devices for people with disabilities to enhance their computer use. So just I want to go through that a little bit and so you know what's currently on the market. This is an interesting battery-powered device that will attach this to any part of the body where you have muscle movement, and it picks up the EMG from the muscle contractions. And then it transmits the signal wirelessly to a Bluetooth to the computer that basically considers that muscle movement, whether it's an eyebrow, you know, movement or some other movement, as a mouse click. So you can use this with other technologies such as an on-screen keyboard. So you can operate a keyboard and do mouse clicks with this device. And for its size, it's pretty expensive, $2,100. But it's sort of unique. I haven't seen anything, you know, quite like that. And because it's wireless, it's pretty convenient. This is an eye position sensor, and basically, it uses an infrared camera to look at your eye position, and it maps the eye position into you know, cursor movement on the screen. There may be, you may have to use a second monitor in order to sort of set it up, which may be sort of confusing. But this kind of device has been around for a while. And again, this is on the expensive side of things. So it's basically substitutes as a mouse. Again, wirelessly. Typical of these devices is the need to calibrate it. It needs to know, you know, where you are, and has to be set up. So it's a little bit tricky. This device has been around for a while. It's basically a joystick that you operate with your mouth, and you actually put it in your mouth and move it around to do mouse controls. But then you can. It has a straw in here, and it can detect when you blow or suck into that straw, which they call sip and puff. So if you don't have use of your arms, you can use this to control a mouse on your computer. And by blowing or sipping or puffing, you can activate the mouse clicks. And an interesting feature is that you can transmit Morse code by Sips and Puffs. This device is made in Canada, and it's been around for a long time. But I'm not sure I know anybody that uses it. You can see it has this arm that's adjustable, and adjustability is sort of critical for any of these devices because everybody has a different sitting position in front of the computer. So you have to set it up for an individual. Again, sort of on the high end of things. This is a head position detector. Doesn't look at your eyes, it looks at your head. And what it specifically looks at is a reflective dot that you put on your forehead, on your eyeglasses, on a baseball cap, or something. And so this device, which is up here, illuminates the field in front of it, and it has a camera in here that can detect where it sees the reflection. It's a small retro-reflective dot. And these things usually work pretty well. Again, with an on-screen keyboard, you can type into your computer, and it also has built-in software to do mouse clicks and right-clicking and dragging and stuff like that. So this is a little bit more reasonable because the technology has gotten cheaper. It probably uses infrared to illuminate the reflective dot. Here's a free application that uses your webcam, and you can, if you have a webcam on your laptop, you can use that, or you can buy one and attach it via a USB port. But it basically tracks your head position with software, and you can use that to replace a mouse. So if you don't have good use of your arms and hands, this is a free alternative. This is a new device that I haven't seen before. It uses a light attached to a headband up here, and you point it at this device here, which has letters and numbers and punctuation marks and other things here. So this is an active device that can detect that light has been pointed at it, and it interfaces with your computer to transmit letters, characters, and it apparently confirms each key, so you don't have to. They say it will reduce error. A lot of times, if you do make an error, it really messes up the speed at which you're communicating, because you have to, you know, tell it that there's an error. And go back and delete it, and then select another letter. So avoiding errors is sort of key in maximizing throughput. If you can't use your hands with a mouse, maybe you can use your feet. And devices like this have been around for a while. So with one foot, you move it around like a mouse, and the other foot you can is for key clicks. And so this probably, plugs right into where you would plug in an external mouse, and it probably, works without any additional software. So that's sort of neat. If you have limited movement of your arms and you can't use a regular keyboard, maybe you can use an expanded keyboard. Maybe you can use a keyboard if the letters are much bigger. So here's a keyboard with large 1-inch square letters. And I measured the keys on my keyboard, and they were like 3/4 of an inch. So this is, this is a third again as big. Again, it probably plugs into the standard keyboard port. If you're a visually impaired person and you're using the display, you can magnify what you see on the screen, both letters and images, using Zoom Text. And so it can blow up letters to 32 times the size. You basically just get, like 2 or 3 letters on the screen. But for a lot of people, that's what they need. You can change the contrast. You can make the letters, different colors. And it can also read what it sees on the display So, and that includes anything that you can put up there, like your emails and web pages and so on. And if you're typing in characters, it will read them to you as you're typing them, so you know that you've entered it correctly. This is a scanning pen. I think there's a number of these on the market. This one allows you to, it's a handheld device that you use to scan printed text, and it will do an optical character recognition on that text and read it back to you in synthetic speech. It also has a feature built in that you can scan a word and have it look it up in a dictionary and tell you what it means. And you can also translate it into other languages. So that's a lot of stuff to have on a $150 device. I talked about this. This is the Intel Reader. It's for people with low vision or for people who are blind. And basically, it reads, it will speak information to you, either stuff that you've entered into it as files, or you can take a picture of something and we'll do an OCR on that and read it to you. And it's obviously set up for somebody who is visually impaired. It's a standalone device, although it has USB, so you can hook it up to thumb drives. And I believe it also plays MP3 files as well. It's made by Intel. Yeah, so this is sort of neat, having a big company get into this field. You know, they've always had an interest in assistive technology, and they've had a lot of people working on healthcare issues and stuff like that over the years. But this is the first major device I've seen them manufacture, and we'll see how it does in the market. This is a PDA for folks who are blind. This one has a built-in hard drive. It's very small and portable. And on the left-hand side, you see a Braille keyboard. And you know, this is a keyboard. These six keys sort of match the six-dot Braille, and so you can enter information that way. There's a voice recorder in here, and it will read back stuff in a synthesized voice, and it can interface to a computer via Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. It apparently can read Word files and surf the web, play music, games, read books and stuff aloud. So, if you're somebody that's blind, you need to have something that's made for you to be a PDA type device. Another similar device is this one here, and you see the Braille keyboard this way, oriented this way, but instead of a voice output, it also has 32 cells of Braille, and these are electronically controlled Braille dots. So 32 characters of Braille will appear across here, and the person who is blind can read that. And it has similar capacity. It doesn't have a hard disk in it, but it has a memory card, USB ports, GPS receiver, and Ethernet, and Wi-Fi built into it. So it's the kind of thing, it would be comparable to a notebook for a visually impaired blind person. The last one is an application for an iPhone or iPod Touch, and it's a software that does audio processing. So it amplifies what it hears, and you can set filters and volume control and stuff like that, and manipulate it so that you can eliminate background noise and figure out where the sound. What frequencies are in the sound and tailor it to the way that is easier for you to hear. So it basically records it does A to D conversion of the sound and goes through this audio processing, but it also saves the last 5 seconds of audio that it hears in its memory. Okay? Any questions on this device? Wayne?
Well, I think in general, David, just kind of some of the logic you've shown to the clients, I think from the beginning of computers, this kind of technology, the main machine interface has been an issue.
Right.
You look at the old sci-fi movies with the big warehouse computer and they're trying to communicate with it. And it seems like we made a big jump, technically, when we went to graphics.
That's right.
From the days of Apple and Windows. And that all of a sudden brought a whole new. It seems, as I've sat with your class, that we may be on the verge of either really much better voice to text or maybe even thought to text. Are you seeing that? I mean, you seem to be fairly flexible.
Right. There's a lot. There's been incremental progress in text to speech and in voice recognition, and so you'll see that continue to improve. I mean, some of the synthesized speech is very good these days, and it's sort of hard to tell it's synthesized. So that's getting better. And as far as voice recognition, I mean, it's getting better as well. But you're still not to the point where you can, it'll arbitrarily, you know, catch 100% of what you say correctly. So people who do use voice recognition, there's still a training process that needs to be done, and it doesn't catch everything correctly. It'll misunderstand you, and sometimes these misunderstandings are pretty bad. And I've heard some horror stories about misrecognitions, especially in public. So that's funny. Reed, did you have a comment?
I was just going to say, as you mentioned thought to speech.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Basically a simplified EEG to concentration levels to guide a ball through obstacle
right.
course.
Well, in the beginning of the course, we heard from people at NeuroSky who has a commercial brain-computer interface. But it basically looks at the state of your mind, relaxed or concentrating or whatever, but it's not reading your thoughts. But they're getting to the point now where they have sort of a thing sort of similar to voice recognition, where you take a look at a picture and it records, you know, whatever brain action there is, and then you do that with lots of pictures, and then so that you have a training mode, and then you go back and the subject is given an arbitrary picture, and the EEG is picked up, and it can go through the database of stuff that it was trained with and figure out which of those pictures, you know, you're looking at now. So a lot of that is happening. But that's still a long way from understanding what you're thinking.
Yeah.
So. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. I did come across an article like that, so.
Claims of the people I've heard that they can reach your thoughts. Okay, that's a sensation. But, you know, you're in something that amounts to, you know, one of these huge scanners. But I think what it does is it maps, it's already mapped the brain, and it knows that what areas of the brain you use for certain things. And I think based on that, when you're asked certain questions,
yeah,
it can tell whether
it's more of a lie detector type of thing,
right,
because
so
you're under stress if you're telling a lie and you use different parts of your brain.
Right.
So I've seen some research in that area as well.
One group that actually claims that they can actually translate your thoughts into speech, so it literally reads it. I mean, I've seen some clips and things of it, but I think.
Okay. yeah, we'll be. They'll be. It'll be interesting. So on Tuesday, we're going to have the student projects presented, and I want to make sure everybody comes to that, because we're going to actually have people here from Stanford News, and they're going to be observing and photographing and videotaping as well. So everybody be prepared for that, and they may want to interview you, take your picture and everything. So it'll be, I hope it'll be a positive opportunity for the class and for individuals here. So, and everybody gets to judge the presentations and the projects. So bring those skills with you on Tuesday. And so that's Tuesday, but today we're going to have Rich Mahoney speak to us. And Rich is from SRI, and he's the director of the robotics program there. And he has, I've known him for ages, he has more than 20 years' experience in this area in research and development and commercialization of healthcare robotics technology, with particular emphasis on assistive and therapy applications. And at SRI, Rich is organizing teams of people to look at the next generation of tools that can improve patient lives and quality of their medical care. So let's welcome Rich.
Sorry, comfortable sitting there. I'm going to stay there for a while. Is that good? Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for having me this evening. The first slide, it says robot applications was what I told Dave months ago, and I've been churning in my head what to talk about, and somewhere along the way I sent him a list of a few items that I wanted to add, but have this soapbox that I'm on around the idea of practical robotics, and I'll give you a little bit of my background and why I'm coming into that perspective. But as Dave is saying, I've been involved in robotics for more than 20 years, and this is one of those talks where I'm getting to the stage where I have enough experience that I'm going to give you some insights that are based on my experience. But if you look at what the kinds of things that I've done is my background's in engineering, so I have a bachelor's and a master's degree from Drexel in Philadelphia and a PhD from Cambridge University in England. And all of my research work in that phase, I consider that my sort of research phase where I was getting exposed to doing research, and at the same time I was introduced to this area of robotic, the use of robotics as assistive technology. One of the things I did at Cambridge, referring to this market survey of visual inspection for manufacturing, and so a theme that started to emerge there and has followed me throughout my career is to really look at, and not just research questions. I'm not really motivated by research for research's sake. I'm motivated by how can we take this technology from the R stage to the D stage into practical use. So I spent a lot of time inspecting manufacturing facilities and looking for areas where robotic technology could be introduced to create more jobs for people who had manipulation disabilities. When I returned to the U.S., I was worked in a robotics lab at the University of Delaware and the AI DuPont Institute in Wilmington, and we were funded by the Department of Education for 5 years to look at broadly at how robotics could be used as an assistive technology. Again, I was sort of moving now from my research to a research and development stage. We're looking at building systems and what was the potential of robotics technology at the time. But what I found also is that in this time from sort of 1990 to 1997, as I'd been working on research and saw firsthand how robotics could be used to create new types of assistive devices, in that time, less and less of that technology, that value that was being demonstrated, was getting out into the market. And I also saw that a lot of the people that were doing research were really focused on the research questions, but not many people were going into the market. That's where my calling was. So I had an opportunity at that time to leave the university research environment and go into a company where I became the director of business development for the rehabilitation technologies division of a small company in northern New Jersey. And that company was an aerospace manufacturer that just had an interest in the use of robotics as an assistive technology. And while I was there, I was involved in introducing into the U.S. market the first U.S. Based robotic wheelchair mounted assistive device. And worked on a number of products. And the one thing that I learned, and I learned a lot during that period, but the one thing I learned is that the best way to be successful is to focus. So in those 7 years there, I had about 9 or 10 different product concepts. So I got out into the market, and I had all these things I wanted to get out there. And we got a lot of things a short distance, but not any one thing a really far distance. And then from there, I had an opportunity really to focus. I became the general manager of it's an Israeli-based company called Motorica, where we introduced a robotic stroke therapy device, and I'll tell you more about that. And then from there, I was attracted to SRI to really have the opportunity to work across the full spectrum of early-stage technology innovation all the way out to transferring things into the market. So I have all this background, but what I'm really excited to do is to see robotics move into the market and bring the value to the world that it really should be bringing. And my goal today is then, given my background, and I would like to give a sort of perspective about robotics. It's something that's out in the public eye, and I think in many ways it's a technology that hasn't arrived or hasn't met expectations. So I'd like to give some perspective on that. And then also some insights that I've gathered through my experiences on what I think it takes to get a product, a robotic product, and I think really any innovation into the market. So I'll quickly just talk about this because I often say that if you go to a robotics conference, you could ruin the agenda by putting a slide like this up, because everybody in the audience would suddenly want to talk about what they think a robot is. And so there's all different kinds of robots, and there's robots that look like people, there's robots that are vacuum cleaners, and there's industrial robots. But a couple of key things jump out is that it's reprogrammable, multifunctional, it uses sensor information, it does things that normally humans do. So these are some broad things to look at. And why are we using robots? That, you know, we don't want to do these things, so we want machines to do them. We don't have the time to do it, and robots can do some things that are actually better. And I'm putting this slide up, and I don't mean to insult anybody, but I was asked to give a talk to my kindergarten age son's class about robotics, and I had 10 minutes to explain to a room full of 6-year-olds what a robot is and what's important about a robot. And I actually find that I come back to this slide a lot. So the idea of robots, they're automatic, so they have some thinking and some computing that they do. They have some sensing that they do, and very broadly, and then they do something with that. So it's really, the idea of a robot is that it's able to act on its own to do something that's interesting. And there's all variations of this, but when you think about a robot, you should think about software and what it's doing, what are the sensors that it has, and what mechanically does it have available to it to do a task. And then there's this whole human-robot interface that's important. So this, I refer to this idea of flexibility, so being able to do a lot of things. And this to me is something, the role of data in the use of a robot, I think is extremely overlooked. And I actually am beginning to talk a lot about the idea that the internet created sort of democratization of information. So we can all go online and we have access to information that the masses now have access to that you never had before. I see robots as the interface between the physical world and that information world. And as such, I think there's opportunities for robots to democratize our physical experiences. So if we're able to capture through the data from the robot our best practices, then we should be able to play that back through the robot eventually. And that's a perspective that I don't I haven't really seen implemented, and it's an area that I intend to do some work. There's also this idea of just automating things that are boring or hard for people to do. So, like, the biggest benefits to date are robots can do things faster than people, some things faster, and they can do boring or dangerous tasks faster. So this idea of dangerous is also important with robots. So the first really successful use of robots are in industrial practice, and there you usually see a robot in a cage moving really fast, doing something, and they're not interacting with humans, but they're taking the place of some task that a human would do. So I had some links to these, but they're actually internet links I discovered afterwards. I don't have a network connection here, do we? Yeah, well, if you can, why don't you bring up, if you can click on either one of them. Oh, great. So it should play. So here's a fast robot. And the thing I point out with this, so it's really fast, it's doing this task, but it's in a cage, right? It's away from the human. So if we'll show the other one now. And this one, if you could start it right in the middle when it comes up. So then here's a dangerous, anywhere in the middle is going to be fine. So here's a dangerous, an example of a dangerous task that robots are now standardly used for, so bomb disposal. And then just a quick visual of what those robots look like.
Yeah, use it was for a barricaded subject inside of a house. It was...
So now what I'll say to you about this is that you look at the quality and compare the quality of the performance of the robot in both cases. So the first robot, really fast, doing a lot of things, really precise.
Power had been cut off in the house, and the infrared cameras were just unbelievable. It was brighter than noontime on a sunny day.
This robot is really a glorified remote control car, and it's the its capability is good, but it's just not as good as you think it should be.
Early versions were used in Bosnia, but these shockproof, weather-resistant robots really are good.
So this is state of the art. This is a state of the art bomb disposal robot, and the screen that that soldier was looking in, and we can stop this quickly. I just wanted to kind of give a right. This is the user interface, and it's.
In 2006, the talent
so you can
safely destroyed
quit that and go back.
Roadside explosives there. But the robots didn't escape unscathed. More than 100 of.
So this is kind of the state of the art, I'll highlight one last time the idea of flexibility of a robot. This is a robot called the Handy One. It was developed in the United Kingdom, and I'm not exactly sure of the commercial status of it, but it was one of the earliest robotic devices that was available on the market, and it was created as a self-feeder. So this is an off-the-shelf, low-end commercial robot that they packaged in this way, and they created a program that would scoop food and feed it to the person that was using it. So there's a number of feeding devices out there, but the power here that I'd like to point out is because this was a robot and it had flexibility and it could be programmed, they were able to extend it to do things like grooming, makeup application, and then ultimately they looked at educational tasks and things like that. So now I'm just trying to give some insight into what are the advantages, what's the opportunity that you have with something that's robotic. So in some, there's some hesitation in my descriptions. I think that robotics have not achieved what their potential are. But on the flip side, robots are everywhere. And people, I don't think, are aware of how much robotic technology, not just automation technology. So automation is just doing the same thing over and over again, no flexibility. I designed this machine to punch that thing 1,000 times a second, and it punches it well, but it could never do anything else. A robot, in the everyday world, an elevator is a form of robot. I believe a powered wheelchair is a form of robot. There are mobile bases out there that we're calling robots, but then we don't call a powered wheelchair a robot. It's completely inconsistent. And there's things like vacuum cleaners now that are emerging. There are things like surgical robots that are emerging, and these are in the market. But another example of a robot that is in front of everybody every day is the hard drive in your computer. It's a robot that does pick and place of information off of the hard disk. It's as much a robot as any of the as these in terms of the way we were describing it earlier, using sensing, using some mechanical operation. Okay, so a little bit more insight. So the Intuitive Surgical is a company that's doing it's extremely successful financially selling robots for doing surgery. And these are their claims, their marketing claims off of their website. So Intuitive Surgical, taking surgery beyond the limits of the human hand, enhancing surgical capability, the breakthrough platform for a minimally invasive surgery, bringing the benefits of minimally invasive surgery to the broadest possible base of patients, market share, clinical efficiency, overall system. So this is what a robot can do in this application. And these claims are the power of robotics. So I'm making this up, but take any kind of application where people are starting to look. And now, what if there was an intuitive lawn care company looking at robotic lawn care, taking lawn care beyond the limits of the human hand, enhancing lawn care capability, the breakthrough platform for automated lawn care. The claims are the same. They're market share growth, work efficiency, overall system-wide benefits. I didn't even have to change that one. It stays the same. So there's a mindset about what robotics can do that is out there, but I don't think it's transferred into every market. So let's look at what's actually happened. So here's a chart that shows the total number of robots that have been installed or delivered in total. So this isn't number per year. This is number since robots were beginning to be shipped commercially. So, and these are 2007 numbers. They're a little bit outdated, but there's not so much activity that they don't make sense. But so here's industrial robots. So these are the robots that are shipped to the factories in Japan and factories in Detroit and used in pharmaceutical companies. Industrial robots, the first video I showed you. So from the 1960s, from the first computer-controlled robot that I think is sitting upstairs in the lobby here, to today, there's been about 1.7 million robots delivered. 1.7, not even, 2 million or less robots that have been delivered. If you look now at what's happening in other markets, so this is industrial. There's two general markets that people look at in the service sector, and one is professional and one is personal. So in professional, the number one application for robots is defense, security, and rescue. Okay, so here's, I'm just trying to figure out how to do this right, but here's 30 years of industrial robots, just under 2 million. Here is 5 to 8 years of defense robots, and that number is about 12,000. So when you hear about these bomb disposal robots and you hear about robots saving lives in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that, you're talking about less than 12,000 robots actually being sold for those purposes. So they're definitely commercially viable, but they're really not haven't penetrated yet, and they haven't become pervasive. The number two application is milking. So this, again, this is in the sort of 10,000 range. And now all of these others, cleaning, underwater applications, construction, medical, general mobile applications, logistics, inspection, and PR, like things like the humanoid robot that stands at your greeting people in some museums in the U.S. So these, you know, this total number here is something like 50,000, so including the defense robots. So in the thousands. So the in terms of the success of robots, we're not there yet. We're seeing things that are that solve problems, and there are companies that are doing it, but there is tons of opportunity to develop robots that are useful. So now if we look in the personal world, what's really interesting, you have the largest number of robots is in the vacuum cleaning area, and iRobot as a company. And so in 2007, that number was around 3.3 million, and they just recently announced they sold their 5 millionth robot. So this number is out here now. We're interacting with a company called Wowee that you might know. They have Roboraptor and some other toys. But the toy market is starting to do well, so there's several million, and I think these numbers are now heading towards 3 million. And then lawnmowers are also doing okay in the personal marketplace. But these are a very small set of the things that robots could do to benefit people. And again, I'm trying to give a reality check here about what's really been accomplished. So there is definitely some things to hang our hat on in terms of what robotics technology has done, sort of the little things that we're not even aware of. This, to me, is the public view of what they want robotics to become and how they want it to benefit the world, and we're still getting there. Now, this is, to me, yes, sorry. Where is the data published? Oh, I'm sorry, I should have put that on there. There's a robotics, there's a world robotics report that's put out every year, and that there's a public version of that that's available, and then there are also some other sort of secondary sources. I can send the reference to that afterwards. I was thinking about that I didn't have it, and then I forgot to go back and put it on. So the big thing that I wanted to show here is not so much this robot, but the idea that the robots are out of the cages now. So we're not talking about robots sitting in cages. We're talking about robots that are working very intimately with people. It's a very different type of robot. It's a very different way of interacting with it. So this also defines some of the requirements and some of the challenges as to why we're not able to move robots more quickly into applications. So a little bit more what's going on with robots. The military in the U.S. and other countries is expanding their interest in the use of robots in to all aspects of military operations. They've over the last couple of years bought thousands. They first invested in the research to create these bomb disposal robots, and then they've gone and bought thousands of them, and now they're interested in getting more and better robots in that area. But they are interested in their warehouse operations. They are interested in other in maintenance operations. They're interested in robotic soldiers, and there are now millions and millions of dollars being spent developing many other applications of robotics for military use. So I showed you already there's some initial consumer robotics companies now in this toys and home services area that have become established, and they're not going away. They're going to continue to grow. Another thing that I think is interesting is that top universities like Stanford and MIT and Carnegie Mellon and Drexel University and other places like that have been putting out robotics engineers for the last 20 or 30 years. And there are more and more robotics programs, more and more roboticists being educated. And complementary to that is there are lots of hobby and high school-based robotics clubs that are emerging. Pretty much every region will have some sort of high school-based club. There's lots of investment by governments around the world, especially in this area of elder care needs. As the world's population is aging, there's an understanding that there's not enough people to take care of that elder population, so they're looking at designing robots to help with that. The market, the people who put money into companies to make them successful, has seen a few paybacks with iRobot and Intuitive Surgical. To me, this is a big stew of things that are happening right now that have not happened before, that I think, I can't tell you, and I can't prognosticate on what I think the breakthrough will be, but just like having the internet and having software capability and other aspects of that available has led to many new companies and many new innovations, I think we're in a similar, we're getting into a similar stage with robotics technology. So stay tuned, but this is where the butt is. This transition to successful commercial applications is really difficult. So I'd love to point out that iRobot and Intuitive Surgical are, by any measure, successful companies, but they both took 10 years to get to that point. So they're not the typical Silicon Valley, we invest and 3 years later they go IPO. These are companies that people spent 10 years plugging away in the market until they actually got to the point where they could be successful. So there's some other issues there. Yes?
I'm sorry. I was going to say, I think you were saying earlier, it kind of leads back into the question I asked David earlier. It almost sounds like you're saying we're waiting for some kind of watershed moment or event to start to bring it forward.
Right.
If you think back about early computers, those numbers you showed were probably very similar in terms of the applications of those systems.
Right.
Very specialized, not general use. Then you move to general use in the internet via social and open source, and then boom, everything explodes.
Right.
And so it sounds like you're saying that we're probably on the verge of that kind of thing.
Right. So I think I believe that we are, but I would say, even though I've been doing this for my entire professional career, I still think I don't know what I don't know in terms of what's going to cause us to go through that threshold, right? So I would, there might have been some people back in the 80s when the internet was starting to percolate into what it's become today, but I'm at SRI, where the recipients of the first email ever sent in the world, and those guys didn't quite know what was going to become of it. So, every decade since I've been doing robotics is the decade of robotics, where people are saying this is the decade when it's going to happen. And I'm not saying that. I'm trying to be careful not to talk that way. But I'm just observing a convergence of things that have not been in place before. Like there's never been a commercial successful companies at this level in both in the military markets, in the consumer markets, in the medical markets that we can point to. We've got 20 plus years now of engineers coming from pretty prestigious programs working in this robotics area. And I really do think that part of it comes down to this. Right. So that's what I'll spend the rest of my time talking about. What I think are the methods for transitioning something commercially. And I don't think we have enough people that are doing that in the robotics field. There's still too much technology push and not enough people diving into the market. But what I'll, before I get into my commercial recommendations, I just wanted to give a couple of slides on the kinds of things that we're doing at SRI that I think are also indicative of the level of technology development that's taking place throughout the world and how these might play into helping us transition. So the I've mentioned Intuitive Surgical a few times, and this company was actually based on technology that was developed at SRI. This is the first remote surgical robot that was ever created, and this was done at SRI back in the mid-1990s. And it was really looking at could we bring the skills of a surgeon into the battlefield? Could we create a robot that could go out onto the battlefield and have a surgeon sitting in a safe place be able to operate on soldiers that were injured? This company is extremely successful and I think is an example of how robotics can benefit people. So from that program at SRI, back since 1992, there's been a number of the company spun out, and then we've looked at new technologies using remote manipulation to solve medical problems, using robots to do microsurgery, telemedicine to assist surgeons in the battlefield to allow multiple surgeons to be able to discuss the needs of soldiers. And then this system here, this open surgery system called the M7, is leading us in some new directions. And there's another operating room of the future that I'll talk about. So this TraumaPod program is an interesting. This is funded by DARPA. And here's the Intuitive Surgical system. So that system was only to do surgery on, it was to help the surgeon do surgery. This project was to look at automating the entire surgical suite, all of the nurses, all of the activities of any other people that would be in there, so that the surgeon could actually operate fully independently. And there's a video for this. Unfortunately, the videos aren't working directly off of that, so I'll have to jump back and forth. But this is the TP tool changer, yes. So there's a surgeon. Are you able to mute that? So there's a surgeon who's actually sitting outside of the room who's directing this robot to hand that new instrument for this part of the surgery that's going on. And what's really interesting about this work is that the automation of this entire suite is really for a robotic engineer. It was pretty straightforward. You go in, you look at the task, you create some fixtures, you identify the robot, you spec it out. It's all. But what was the real research, the real development in this project was how to create a user interface between the doctor and this environment that allowed them to operate safely, efficiently, and even added some other advantages for the surgeon and the patient. Okay, so we flip back. There's one person. There is a second. This is more of a quality control kind of position, but this entire surgery is being guided by that one person. So, another project. If we could show the video, and this one is. Yeah, but let's jump over that one. Go M7 Medical. M7 Medical. So now this M7 is the robot that the follow-on work at SRI on surgical robotics. So this is the internal development that we've done. This robot is designed to be a full extension of the human arms, and that it is operated with two input handles. And it is designed to perfectly reflect your movement so that you can do dexterous manipulation remotely. So this is being controlled by an individual sitting at, I'll show you this, the workstation, and he's able to, you can see there's sort of a human-like quality to the types of movement. This is very atypical for, you've seen robotic motions that are just very robotic, and this changes that viewpoint. And the another perspective here is that there is a machine now. So here's the person, a computer, and a machine. That machine, even though it's under human control, is still performing that dexterous task. So we're demonstrating that a robot is capable of this level of performance. What we just don't know yet how to build the human equivalent of the input, but that's part of the work that we're looking at. Can we create robots that work this dexterously using software to independently perform those tasks? So if we go back to the slides. So this is the input, and these are the two handles there. But there's a lot of work in this area now looking at how can we, DARPA is actually just getting ready to fund a major program to advance the manipulation capability of robotics. Right, right. So I would say yes, but I think they're doing it piecemeal. They're not doing it as a grand vision. So this project is this one I just referred to for DARPA will solve some narrow issues around manipulation, but it will not result in landing this on the moon and demonstrating it that way. So what I'm looking to brand the work that we do at SRI around for robotics is to look at the idea of redefining the design space for next generation robotics. So some of that movement that you saw in that previous, that human-like movement, is part of what we're trying to accomplish. But at SRI, we have some new technologies, one called electroactive polymers. It's a artificial muscle. It's a type of plastic that has similar power density to human muscle. So for the same shape and size as human muscle, you can get similar kinds of power and movement, and very, very inexpensive. So it's really early stage for this technology. We have other things called metamaterials, which are materials that can change their properties, become very stiff or very compliant using electrical and other techniques. Electroadhesion is taking the power of rubbing a balloon on your head and sticking it on the wall and just being able to control that and use it for applications like wall climbing that I'll demonstrate. And then there's some discussion about artificial intelligence, human user interfaces, video and speech content. And there's a lot of work at SRI and other places that are planting the seeds for this to be integrated into robotics technology. So I'll show you quickly. If you could, there's a Murbot video. So this is Murbot is a robot with no electromechanical components to it. So there are no motors in this. All of that movement is through this artificial muscle. It's this composite plastic material that's allowing this to move. And you can see it's a different feel of what a robot can do. The advantages here are the power is less. There's no form factor to that leg. We sort of just shaped it for legs, but it doesn't have to be. You know, when you've got, think about any motor and the engines that drive your car. That engine has to look a certain way, and the cars are built around it. These motors can be designed to work any way that you want. You can shape them any way that you want relative to the task. And then the other video is the wall climbing. I'm sorry? So this electroactive polymer is actually causing the movement. So it's, I'm sorry? Yes, yeah. So it's pulling the layers together and causing it to flex as it's doing that. So there's a fair amount, if you're interested, there's a fair amount of that on the internet that you can find. And so this is a wall climbing robot that we demonstrated last year and that we're now beginning to develop more applications for. And so this is just sticking to the wall and moving up and down. And if you think about that, it's static electricity, the same thing I described when you rub a balloon on your hair. And so we have just invented a way to turn that on and off. And there's lots of applications for this. In terms of inspection, we have a company in Japan that wants to build inspection robots for bridges. There's application for gripping. So right now you need a motor to close a gripper to pick something up. With this technology, the adhesion actually allows you to grab things without any kind of motor or clamping. It's a really interesting technology that we're just beginning to discover the benefits for. So if we go back to the slides. So one big thing about these technologies that is interesting for us is that these motors, the electroadhesion, these are really inexpensive. They're made out of plastics. And one of the things that we're looking at doing is creating robots that have the ability to perform at the level of really expensive electromechanical robots. And we believe this is a possible way of getting more things into the market, just because they'll be more accessible cost-wise. So this is where I switch from, okay, I've told you kind of what's going on with robots in the world. There's lots of opportunity to do things. But how do we get them into... I left a job in 1997 because I wanted to figure out how to get robots into the real world, commercially viable robots. I won't read through all this because I'm going to highlight it, but there are specific things when you're introducing a new product that I found are really important to do around that are geared towards being practically successful, taking something that you want to be a product and making it available. And what I'm going to use as an example of from my experience was this product that I helped bring to market called the Rio Go or Rio Therapy. It's a robot facilitated neurorehabilitation, so recovery of arm function for patients who've had a stroke. And this robot does things that robots do. It automated the labor-intensive neurorehabilitation process. It collected data that we could use to document the therapy activity and the assessment of the patient's progress. And it also allowed you to dose and understand the exact amount of therapy that patients were giving you, so that you were giving patients. So a robot in every sense of the word, but not yet in the market or successful. So this was the product, and it's really just a big joystick. So you saw it there. It sits next to the patient, and it has a quick disconnect handle so you can hold the patient's arm, and it has a computer screen that shows the games and the activities that the patient would do. And then this is what the patient would see, and they'd be asked to just perform these movements to follow the red marker. And for neuro recovery, it's not sufficient to just move your arm, but you need to be moving your arm in a functionally oriented task in which you are engaged. So just having a therapist sitting there stretching your arm is good for muscle tone and keeping the arm loose, but it's not good for neuro recovery. So this is a system that automates that engagement process in interacting with the patient. So there's actually a video here if you want to show just how it works. And this is the... yes, that one. So you can see it looks like a stick shift, a manual stick shift in a car, but the robot, the base is automated, and what's happening is that it's measuring the movement intention of the patient, and then assisting the patient depending on the mode that it's in and how well the patient's doing. So patients that are don't have a lot of ability, as long as they get just a little bit of the correct movement, the robot will assist them to complete the task. And then patients that are much more advanced will have much more challenging, will be expected to actually do a lot of the movement on their own. Okay, so if we can flip back to the slides. There were already established clinical benefits for this type of therapy. Here's an example of a guy who wasn't able to move his arm above his head. He wasn't able to... there's some videos here, but I think it will take too long to show them exactly. And after 3 weeks of doing this therapy intensely, a couple hours a day, he was able to move his arm much more comfortably and to extend it over his head. So here's what I want to talk about. So in less than 3 years, so I was hired in 2004 as the general manager. I was the first hire in the U.S. The company was based in Israel. They had a paper design for what they wanted to do. So there was nothing else in the U.S. I was the first person, and I had the chance of how am I going to introduce this product into the market. And in less than 3 years, we had 50-plus installations. We had integrated a new product into our product line, and we had begun development of a home product. It was really a great experience, and there's some specific things that we did that I think were really important to that. So the very first thing I did was go and look for the best advisors and opinion leaders that I could find. So we'll show these two people are people that I didn't know them before. I kind of knew of them, and I.
Asia would typically stay 2 to 3 months in the hospital. The exact same patient clinically today stays 2 to 3 weeks.
So there's really a dilemma. Do you spend the 3 weeks teaching the daily living skills in a compensatory fashion so that they can leave the hospital able to dress and eat and bathe? Or do you take that time and try to re-educate the arm?
Okay, so I'm gonna jump through these quickly. So Bruce Ganz is the president of the Physical Medicine Association, the top physiatrist in the country. I didn't know him. I called him up. I said, this is what I'm doing. I went and talked to him. It turns out that he loves Star Trek. He managed the first robotics lab at Tufts University Medical Center in the 80s. I met a lot of doctors. So I went and I lucked out with Bruce. I spent a lot of time talking to doctors, getting to know doctors. And Bruce ended up being the right person to be my advisor. The same thing with Susan Ryerson. She's a well-known physical therapist in the neuro field. I talked to a lot of therapists. A lot of therapists said, you're trying to replace me. I have no interest in talking to you. Susan understood what we were trying to do and engaged with us. And what's really, for me, it was finding the strongest possible advisors that I could, and that I would talk to them, and anything that I wanted to try, I would make sure I shared it with them first and got their input on it. So now the other important part when you're really early is getting out into the market and finding the innovators and the early adopters. So there's a curve here. I won't take the time to explain it, but the early adopters are the people that are willing, they're the risk takers, they're the calculated risk takers, the people that are willing to try something because they know there's a need and they understand what you're trying to do, and they're willing to actually work with you to accomplish it. And the same way I say get out into the market, the same way as I was saying with Bruce and Susan, I visited a lot of rehab hospitals, a lot of rehab clinics, until I found a couple of clinics where I really connected with the people in terms of understanding the need, understanding the potential of robotics technology, being able to talk about the business side of it, and together we created a single vision of what we were trying to accomplish. It wasn't just me selling a product. You're creating a mission, and you're creating a group of people around you that believe in that mission. And listen, iterate. You have to talk it through. Take the feedback, put it into your vision, and ultimately, when you come up with a product, we were able to introduce it through an early adopter program, where our early adopters had the benefit of the technology. Know the business model. So, from the very beginning, start thinking about what the business model is. If you really want this to be a product, you can't build it and come and ask somebody if they would want to buy it after you're done. You have to start thinking about how many can I sell, what will it cost, who's going to buy it, how will my company make money so that I can actually survive, so I can build this more, and that the other companies will want to buy it from me because they know I'm a stable company and I'm going to be around in 5 years. Find a way as quickly as possible to take that product idea and put it into the market. And one of the ways that I focus on that is this concept of minimum usable product. Work with the early adopters, define the absolutely necessary features of the product, and then ask them what would you be willing to pay for that, and figure out how to get that into your business model. And this is something that engineers don't do enough, and roboticists don't do enough, is really they want to build a fantastic robot, or they don't, or they're sheepish about asking how much would you pay for it. But if you really want your product to get into the market, you have to do this from the very beginning. And the other thing is you have to do is be real, accomplish all the market requirements. I had a medical product I was working on. We went and got our FDA approval. Spent a lot of time investigating how it would be reimbursed, all kinds of things, and that when we put it into a hospital for the first time, that it was a fully qualified product, meeting all of the medical obligations. And by the way, this is the very first version of it that we built. The minimum usable product looked like this, and you can see what the final product evolved to. But we started out going after just moving quickly and getting something in the market so that we could validate the product. The right team for the right stage. So I was the first hire. This guy here, Tom Butler, was my second hire. And Tom was, how audacious we were, the vice president of sales. So my second hire, so it was an engineering team in Israel, so it's not totally fair, but my second hire in the U.S., the second person in the company, was the sales manager. And those people at that stage have to be able to adapt on the fly. So Tom is really great with him. He came out of a big medical device company, and he was really interested in an early stage company. It took him a while to get used to how quickly things change, and you have to adapt. But he really came to love it. And you're looking for customer focus, because those early adopters are your gold, and you have to treat them like gold, make them feel comfortable with you, and you need people that know how to do that. It's not everybody's forte. And those people help you establish the reputation of the company. Tom, I interviewed probably 40 people, and Tom met everything I was looking for. And one of the big things was to create an image of the company that was professional, that was energetic, and that, you know, if you looked at what a large pharmaceutical company salesperson would be bringing to the table, I was looking for the similar thing in Tom. And you can just see that all comes across here in this picture. And then sort of apparent to what I was saying before, you saw the first product and then the product that eventually emerged, is that once you get in the market, you have to be willing to evolve. You can't sit there and wait for things to happen. You have to keep working it and making sure you have it right. And here's an example, this Rio Stream. One of the things we began to do was to convert instead of selling the robot to the hospitals, we placed it in the hospital and sold the therapy plans associated with it, and as just another way to look at it. Okay, so now I'll just summarize. I've tried to give you a general state of the robotics market. I believe it's already affecting our everyday life in ways that that aren't apparent. There are these consumer successes emerging, and there's this stew cooking right now that I've been talking about. And I think we're going to see some things happen that we weren't expecting. I don't know what they are, but we're going to see something within the next 5 years. And I think the kinds of things that I'm talking about, they'll emerge from those kinds of activities, from people with the right technical background willing to dive into the market and really listen, really iterate, and be able to connect the benefits of the technology to some market need. And robotics, you know, as much as information technology, it's something that can be applied in many different areas. It's not just medical, it's not just military, it's not just consumer. There's lots of benefit that it can bring to us. So I brought that quickly to an end. I hope that was interesting to you and worthwhile. And if you have any questions or anything you'd like to talk about, I'd be glad to stay and chat for a few minutes.
Rich, thanks so much.
You're welcome. questions? Yes. There are people that I work with that had some interaction with them, but almost, no, I would say not that I work with directly. There's a couple people there that were involved in setting the company up from the SRI's point of view, but most of the technical people went with the company. Yeah, but we interact with them quite a bit still. Yes. I absolutely think there will be. I don't know if that's something that will be in the next 5 years, but there are many people working on robots that look and act more human-like, and they're working on them for the purpose of being assistants, being able to do home tasks and very much the way that you see in science fiction movies. So several companies in this area. Stanford works with them. There's probably five different companies in this area alone that are working on that. And what's also one of the reasons I think it will happen is that in Asia, in Korea and Japan and China in particular, they are investing a lot of money by their governments in robots like that because of in those countries there's a very big elderly population that they don't have the younger population to care for. And our country is heading in that direction. We're about 20 years behind those countries, but there's a big need for more robots that can work that way. And so I think it will, as long as the need is there, we'll continue to work at it. Yes? The safety? Yes. So safety is a really complicated area. So I have this story that I tell. So I was an advisor for a research group at Rehab Institute of Chicago that was working on stroke therapy robots in a research sense. And I had just finished putting a robot into the market that was working with people that had strokes. So there's all safety issues that we addressed for that. The marketplace required FDA safety level. So everything we did to bring that robot was already covered by the FDA. So if you think about the robot application, the market almost always has requirements for safety. And the issue to me isn't so much the robotic technology being safe, it's meshing the robotic technology with the safety requirements of that market. So we were able to do it in the medical marketplace. And the story with the researchers was they wanted to do research on safety and how can we build safer robots. And I just put a robot in the market and met all the safety requirements of the FDA. And my point is that you have to do it in the context of what market you're serving. It's not just a matter of being, are cars safe? You know, cars are an example of something that add value, and the safety standards evolve in the market. And robotics can be introduced in a practical way. Not that robots, you want them to create some of the hazards that cars do, but the same idea of any consumer product will go through an iteration of safety. For some reason, robots have a standard applied to them, which is different than a blender or a car even. It's a really interesting problem, I think. There's no, yes.
The company that you were with
Right, so that company is still in existence, and one of the things that we were able to accomplish was a business arrangement with HealthSouth Corporation, which is a large network of rehab hospitals. So they're actually working to integrate those into that into that hospital network. There are also some changes going on in the market. For instance, the state of Indiana recently approved robotic therapy for children with cerebral palsy as a reimbursable public, but from public health. And it, so those kinds of things are actually driving the potential for more success with those companies. But it's a, they're in the early, they're still in the early stage of building up the market acceptance. And you know, one thing I didn't mention is that you know those 3 years took about $2.5 million investment to get there. So there is, you know, you need to have the right level of investment to support the needs to get into the into these markets.
Fred, we're going to have to call it quits, but I want to thank Fred once again.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you, everyone.